So I finished Interpretations, and I want to talk about some spend these last two lectures talking about stuff that's a little bit more recent. So what I'm going to talk about today is well, some of my own work, not that recent, it's from 2001. This was in this. That paper in the archive. So the question is, you saw the axioms I wrote down for quantum theory. I mean, in the first or second lecture, I forget which one, and they're fairly abstract. Not clear where they come from. And what we want to do is think of some more reasonable axioms that are less abstract, that give us quantum theory. So just to motivate that, let's look at some examples from history. So we had, for example, Kepler's laws. Kepler's laws for planetary motion. You know, the planets move on an ellipse, sun at one of the focal points, the equal areas swept out in equal times, and so on. So Kepler came to these laws by looking at the data, and they were pretty accurate for planets, but they weren't really explanatory. And he went over to Newton's laws, so his law of gravity plus his laws of mechanics. Then you have something that's more like an explanation for what's going on. So it seems that this is a better kind of physics than this. Another example would be that the Lorentz transmissions. Lorentz transmissions are sort of fairly ad hoc. Also, they're pretty weird. If you look at those, it's hard to know why nature would use those transformations. And then Einstein had his postulates. Special relativity. And these seem much more explanatory than just stating these odd-looking transformations. And well, we have the usual axioms of quantum theory. Which are, in terms of Hilbert space, fairly abstract. It's not really clear where they come from. And so the question is, can we do something like this over here? And there's a potential payoff if you do, because it helps you to go beyond. So in the case of Newton's laws, even if you just restrict yourself to the motion of heavenly bodies, then you get not just the elliptical orbits of planets, but also hyperbolic orbits of objects coming in from outside the solar system. And then, of course, Newton's laws also enable us to predict a lot more, like the corrections to the planetary motions because of interactions in the planets and so on. All sorts of stuff that can be predicted. In the case of Einstein's postulates for special relativity, he was able to go a lot further. For example, the mass energy equivalence is something you get from here, and you didn't get it from the Lorentz transformations. So so here you're able to go beyond what you could do here. And of course, also his theory of special relativity led to the theory of general relativity. So so this way of thinking was better than this. And so if we can do something here, then perhaps it can help us go beyond to perhaps a new theory of quantum gravity, or who knows where this might take us, if we can do something successful in this way of thinking. So what I'm going to present is not by any means the end of the story. It's just an attempt in this direction. If you do manage to put a good answer in place of this question mark, you find yourself in good company. So I want to write down a set of axioms for quantum theory. But first of all, I need to describe a framework, a set of postulates for quantum theory. I want to present a framework in which there's new postulates might apply. And this is the framework of general probability theories. You'll hear people in foundations, quantum foundations, talk about GPTs a lot. So I'm going to motivate these general probability theories from quantum theory. So in quantum theory, you can have a preparation of some mixed state rho. Is everyone familiar with what a mixed state is? And then you can have a measurement. So your system goes here, then you have a measurement, and we're interested in the probability of some particular outcome. And in quantum theory, associated with every outcome is a positive operator. A is a positive operator. It could be a projection operator, for example. Then the probability, you see this outcome is given by the trace of positive operator acting on the density matrix. This is a linear product between rho and A. And what you can do is you can associate this here with a vector composed of a list of probabilities. I'll explain what I mean by that in a moment. And you can associate this by another vector consisting of a list of real numbers. You take the dot product, and that probability is equal then to R dot P. Or R transpose P. So it's a list of probabilities. And and I'll explain where you can get this list of probabilities in the case of quantum theory. You have a question? But as an example, I think I gave you this example before. If you take the density matrix for a spin half system, so this is the density matrix for spin half particle. They have probability of spin up along the z direction, probability of spin down along the z direction, and then some off diagonal terms. A is equal to so A is a linear combination of these probabilities. And that means you can write the same information that's in rho in that vector. And I did write this down in the previous lecture. So that's in the case of a spin half system. In the case of a general system, which may have a bigger Hilbert space, you'll need some number of probabilities, k.
Why we don't need py plus and p minus?
Say again, sorry.
Py plus and p minus two.
So if the density matrix is normalized, then, your question was why don't we need y plus and y minus? Okay, so I'll carry on with this. The reason is that that the sum of px plus pz plus is equal to the sum of py plus e y minus, and the same with x's. And so if you know pz plus and pz minus, you know py. Oh, sorry. No question, yeah. That's the mistake. And that's what you were saying. Thank you. I was quite surprised when I saw that you could just represent a state by a list of probabilities. This is an observation that goes back into the 60s, I think before that. It's pretty surprising because you think, well, quantum theory is about amplitudes, work with square roots of probabilities. But actually, no, you can represent you're actually working, the density matrix is actually an object which is linear over it. Yeah, go ahead.
Is pz minus just 1 minus pz plus?
Only if you have a state that's normalized. And it's quite convenient to work with states which are subnormalized in this kind of theories. People normally renormalize states, but when you renormalize a state, you lose some physical information. The normalization of the state is the probability associated with that state. It's especially important if you have preparation like this, where a light can flash. This light can flash, or this one can flash. If this light flashes, there's a certain probability that light flashes, and associated with that, there's a certain density matrix. And then this density matrix would not be normalized. The normalization would be equal to the probability of that light flashing. You could renormalize it by dividing in your way, but then you're throwing away some. So it turns out to be convenient not to. Okay. So in general we have this, and we just choose a sort of minimal set of probabilities. Let me explain what I mean by that. So in general, and now I'm just talking about not quantum, not just quantum theory, any probabilistic theory really of this that pertains to boxes like this, you have some preparation, some measurement, and you're interested in a particular outcome, then you can represent the state by a list of probabilities, where alpha runs over every single outcome of every single measurement. And so you would have a very, very long list here. In principle, this list could be infinitely long. So if this, for example, was a spin half particle, then alpha would run over every outcome of every possible spin measurement. So there's an infinite number of possible spin measurements, each having two outcomes. So this will be a very long list. So generally speaking, you can compress down to a shorter list. In the example of a spin half particle, it's sufficient just to give those four probabilities. Generally, you can compress down to a shorter list. And this is the thing I call P, this vector P. Go down to K. And we do so in such a way that you can get any probability in this longer list by a linear equation of the type that I wrote here. Okay, so now every p alpha can be given by some vector r alpha dot product with that. And you might ask why we use this kind of linear compression. Well, one answer to that is you are simply free to restrict yourself to linear compression. It might be that you could do better than linear. You might be have even an even smaller list of probabilities, where the equation to extract the other ones was not a linear equation but some other kind of equation. And that's actually true in quantum theory if you restrict yourself to pure states. But as long as you allow arbitrary states, then linear is the best that you can do. And just say a bit about that. But in quantum theory, a general state is given by, can always be written like this. This is a density matrix. You can write it as this. You can mix together other states. You can think of this as where you take a coin, a lambda biased coin, and you toss it. If you get the one outcome, you prepare row A. If you get the other outcome, you prepare row B. So mixing these things together will give you an arbitrary. It is states. A pure state is one that cannot be given by a mixture like this in a non-trivial way. It says one that you can't give as a mixture like this, where rho A and rho B are different, and lambda is not equal to 0, 1. So PSA cannot be written as a mixture. And since the relationship between rho and P is linear, that means we can also pair states like this. We have the corresponding mixing in the P representation. Like so. And so what this means is that the space of allowed states, whether they're represented by rho or by these P vectors, is convex. So for example, this shape wouldn't be a set of allowed states, because you'd have a state here, PA, and a state here, PB. Then you could mix them. When you mix them, you get all the states in between. And these states fall outside that set. So this is not allowed. Something like this is allowed. Or even you can even have something like this with a straight edge. So sets of states have to be convex. So these are some vectors, okay, that you can prepare. These are different vectors corresponding to different preparations. And in the space represented by this probabilities, so okay, on the blackboard, I can only draw three of them. Now you have a space. And then there's the states that are allowed fall inside some subset of the space. Okay. So that's the space of states. And this is the shape that has to be convex.
And it has to be convex because...
If it wasn't convex, this is assuming you allow arbitrary mixing. Okay, so you can have any coin with an arbitrary lambda weighting. And then you can toss this. You can toss the coin. If you get heads, you prepare this state. If you get tails, you prepare this state. So in that way, you can reach any of the points on here. So if lambda equals one, you get this is rho A, or this is PA. Then you get this one, B. If lambda equals zero, you get this one. If all the other values are lambda, you get ones in between. And the way I've drawn this set, these ones are not in this space. So this doesn't make sense. That's why the space has to be a convex. Is that clear?
Thank you.
Okay. So I'm motivating this way of thinking, this very general way of thinking about operational theories with respect to quantum theory. So let me carry on doing that.
Can I ask a question?
Yep.
Having a list of probability, we can construct the density matrix uniquely, right?
Yes.
But having the density matrix, we cannot construct the state of the system uniquely. And from here, I was thinking that, like...
So what was that? So you said having a density matrix, we cannot...
There are multiple, like, there are...
Ah, okay. That correspond to the There's many pure states that are in the... So here now, I think the state is the mixed state.
Okay.
But it's true, for any given mixed state, there are many different... sums over pure states, mixtures over pure states that you can write.
What do you mean here by a state is just density matrix?
I mean the thing that's analogous to a density matrix, yeah. There's an attitude difference here you find between different communities. So for example, people in quantum information tend to think of mixed states as the fundamental object. Okay. And whereas people in, say, quantum gravity particle physics tend to think of pure states as if that was the fundamental object. And there's arguments in both directions. So an argument that pure states are the fundamental object is, well, you can't refine any further than that, so that's the most fundamental object. An argument, say, that mixed states are the fundamental object, I'll say, well, a general mixed state will actually have many different decompositions into pure states. And so it's not as if there is a pure state really when you have a mixed situation. There's even people talk about the church of the smaller Hilbert space and the church of the larger Hilbert space. So the church of the larger Hilbert space is where you imagine there's some big Hilbert space for the whole universe, and the whole universe is in a pure state. That's the larger Hilbert space. And then from that point of view, if you're a member of that church, then you mixed states would only be a consequence of looking at some smaller subsystem, and you trace out everything else. Okay, but you fundamentally believe that there is a pure state for the whole universe. So the de Broglie-Bohm and the many worlds approach is firmly rooted in the Church of the larger Hilbert space. Whereas the Church of the smaller Hilbert space, you say, well, no, the smaller Hilbert space is the fundamental thing, and the system is unto itself. And there isn't necessarily a big Hilbert space where the universe is in a pure state. So there's a different attitude. So for the sake of this lecture, I'm now rooted in the Church of the smaller Hilbert space. So for me, P or rho is the state. Okay. So now, how would we get these probabilities in the case of quantum theory? Well, we could form a set of projection operators. And we go from k equals 1 to k equals n squared, and n is the Hilbert space dimension. And so it's a fact, and I'll explain this later, that you can span the space of Hermitian operators by a set of linearly independent, sorry, of n squared linearly independent projection operators. Okay, so this is a spanning set of the space of Hermitian operators. And so that means that you can write down rho as rho as a sum over these projectors with some real weights. The Hermitian operators live in a real space. And let me just, I mean, I'm not going to give a completely rigorous argument, but let me convince you that n squared is the right number of projection operators. Oh, actually, before I do that, let me see. So if you've got these projection operators, n squared of them, then you can write down the state, p state, you can write it down as so the kth entry now in the state is given by the probability of the outcome where you measure this K projection operator, so the trace of PK acting on rho. So let me show you why there are n squared. If I write down a density matrix for a general n-dimensional Hilbert space situation, so where I have a density matrix acting on an n-dimensional Hilbert space, then down the diagonal, I'll have probabilities. Okay. And there are n of those. Okay, and then also, if you look at the entries above the diagonal, here I have n times n minus 1 over 2 of them. That's the number of entries here above the diagonal. And each of these numbers above the diagonal can be complex. So the total, can you see this part of the blackboard? Right up here. The total number of real parameters in here is n, this is the ones down the diagonal, plus n times n minus 1 over 2. And then because each of these is complex, I put a 2 there. Okay. And so that's the number of real parameters required to specify the state. And we're representing the state now by a list of real parameters, the probabilities. So these two numbers must clearly be the same. So k is equal to n plus, well, this, which is just equal to n squared. Crucially, this works because we have complex numbers here. If we had a real, if we had the real case where our, where all the entries were real, then we'd have a 1 here. And if the entries above and below the diagonal were quaternionic, we'd have a 4. Okay. So that's the situation where we have that's the situation for quantum theory. What about for classical probability theory? Okay. Well, in the case of classical probability theory, if you have, for example, a die has 6 sides, then you want a probability for each of those numbers to come up. Okay, if the die is fair, then each of those probabilities is equal to 1/6. But if it's an unfair die, they could be different. So then you'd want to give the probability for each of these possibilities from 1 through to 6. N in this case is the maximum number of situations that can be distinguished. Can be reliably distinguished. What do I mean by that? Imagine you have coming in some set of preparations, and here I have lots of different outcomes. Okay. Say I have the kth preparation. The nth preparation. Okay, so I have the nth preparation. I want it to be that I can find a measurement here so that each of these different preparations in a set will cause different outcomes to fire. So in quantum theory, I can choose preparations that correspond to a basis set. So for example, a spin-half system, I can have spin up and spin down. Those two preparations are reliably distinguishable. Like you can distinguish them in one in one measurement. And in the classical case, I can distinguish if there's like a, if it's a die, I can distinguish each of the six sides. I can have measurements. I can have preparations where I just put the die down and the six is up, or I put it down where the six is or the five is up. So those are six preparations, and they're each distinguishable by an appropriate measurement. So we can have an operational understanding of what we mean by n. So n is the maximum number. Of reliably distinguishable preparations for a given system type. Is that clear? What I mean by that? So n in quantum theory is the dimension of the Hilbert space. N in classical theory is the number of alternatives that you have. And a general state in the classical probability theory is given by a list of n probabilities. So in the classical case, we have k equals n. In the quantum case, we have k equals n squared, which does suggest a pattern. N to the power r, where r is an integer, and actually later I'll show you that there is a hierarchy of theories. Well, there's reasons to consider a hierarchy of theories, where we have k equals n squared, k equals n cubed, and so on. So far, no one has really found any physically reasonable theories that live higher up in this hierarchy, but it's interesting to consider them. One more thing you can do in this GPT framework is consider transformations. So you have some preparation, some transformation, some measurement with an outcome. In quantum theory, the probability is given by the trace of the positive operator associated with this measurement times a super operator associated with the transformation acting on the density matrix associated with the preparation. And this super operator is a completely positive map. You may or may not have covered those in many courses. I'm not going to go into any detail what they are. But if you go into the GPT language, then you can write this down as, you can write down this, the effect of this completely positive map as a matrix, just as a matrix acting on the state P. So like so.
Still in classical,
this works for both classical and quantum probability theory. It works in
operators in classical.
Here I was motivating this structure from the quantum case, but this structure I've shown you also works in the classical case. So if I have a classical preparation like this and I send it through a box, what happens to it is represented by a matrix. It's just if the system that goes in is the same as the system that goes out, then it's going to be a square matrix. And each of these objects, so P will belong to some space, R will belong to some space, and the z's will belong to some space. So if you know these spaces, each type of system, then you're beginning to, you're characterizing the physical theory that you have. Okay. Hey, yeah, go ahead.
When we say that, like, if we send a state to, I don't know, some black box and then get another state and you want to represent it by a matrix, but, like, it has the assumption that you're assuming that, like, all kinds of operations, they act linearly.
Yeah.
But it's not the case in classical, at least.
So
probably because of Hilbert space, we can always construct.
Okay.
But, like, in classical,
So certainly people talk about non-linearity in classical physics and indeed in quantum physics, but the word, when you use the word linear or non-linear, you have to be clear what it, you're referring to. So in quantum theory, you can have non-linear Hamiltonians, for example, but they don't affect this linearity. The state always evolves linearly. In classical systems, you can have, you know, also some non-linear dynamics. But if you're looking at just probabilities, so you're looking at probability theory, just in probability theory, outcomes, then it does evolve linearly, and it kind of has to, because I mean, I can point you to a proof in that paper as to why these transformations have to be linear, but the reasoning is, if you send in just PA by itself, then what you'll get out is ZA. ZPA. You'll get some map acting on ZPA. And if you send in just PB, this map is associated with the transformation. If you send in just PB, you'll get some map associated acting, the same map acting on PB. Now at this stage, maybe these maps are nonlinear, but it has to be, but they have to satisfy. They have to satisfy that the same map acting on this is given by that, because this is just a coin toss. So you can look at the proportion of cases where you see lambda A, and in those cases this has to hold. What I'm trying to say is, let's look just at the case where we look. Let's look just at the, say, the kth entry of this. So, then we better have that, because. We can just regard these two ensembles separately. This is the probability that we get. This has got to be true. And then furthermore, if we act on this some map, how to write this. So now, if we now send this through the transformation, we've got to have still the same. So now we get the primed probabilities here after the transformation. You've got to have the same linear relationship afterwards as well. And so this linearity property that I'm talking about here, you can use that to prove that the transformation has to be linear. It's not completely obvious, but it's fairly straightforward.
Right. But why we don't have any like mixed term of like FA and FB? Maybe that's the question that I'm asking.
Sorry, F?
Yeah, some linear map, like having another term there after applying this kind of operation, like any.
Just think about physically what's happening here. I send it. Imagine I do it in. I send it through a box. I send PA through a box, or I send PB through the box. In a certain proportion of cases. I'm going to get, you know, so in that, in a certain, I do this in the portion lambda cases. Is that clear? Okay. So this has to be true, just given what we mean by mixing, by this using this point. And then once you've got this, you can use that to prove linearity in the transition. Yep.
You mentioned some hierarchy theories.
Yeah.
The fact that K is n squared for quantum theory is related to the fact that it is complex valued.
Yeah.
Suppose we had quaternionic, then we will have hierarchy theories with different
n. No. So, what's interesting is if you have, say, real or quaternionic, then you still have a quadratic function. K is equal to quadratic function of n, but it's not a power. You can see that here. If, say, that instead of a 2, we have a 1 or a 4 there, we still get a quadratic function, not a power. And this is to do with a property which I'll talk about called tomographic locality. Okay, I'll explain what I mean by that. So both the real and the quaternionic cases fail to satisfy this key property called tomographic locality, whereas the complex case does. So turning that around, if you're trying to find a reason for complex numbers in quantum theory, this is part of the reason that you need it, so that you get k equals n squared. So you satisfy this important property. Okay. Actually, I'm going to talk about tomographic locality next. So. So imagine you have a composite system. Like this. So you have some preparation and it prepares two systems, A and B. And then we're interested in what K AB is. So K, this integer here, the number of probabilities in the state. And the assumption of tomographic locality is that K should be equal to KA times KB. And a different way of stating this assumption of tomographic locality is to say that if you have a preparation of some state, then it's possible to determine what that state is equal to by making measurements separately on each of the subsystems and looking at the probabilities, the correlations that you get. So that's what tomographic locality means. That you can determine the state by making separate measurements in each of the subsystems. There's a more general property called n-local tomography, where you sort of generalize this idea. You consider making a more general situation, but this is the property I want to say, tomographic locality. And so you can see. You'll see that if you have this and a few more assumptions, you have to have k equals n to the power r. And so complex is the only possibility there. It can't be real or quaternionic. And then the other assumption is this. NAB should be equal to NA times NB. And I call that information locality. If you take the log of that equation, then you have that the information carrying capacity of the composite is given by the sum of the information carrying capacities of each of the components.
Is it equal to, assuming there's a tensor product structure?
Yeah, so exactly, yeah. So in quantum theory, because you have a tensor product structure, you have this. In classical probability theory, if you have like a die and a coin,
So 6 and 2, well, the total number of possibilities is 6 times 2. So it seems very natural because, you know, if you have two memory sticks, one that carries 6 megabytes and the other one carries 2 megabytes, I'm thinking in the wrong decade, one that carries 6 gigabytes and the other one that carries 2 gigabytes, then the total number of gigabytes you have is 8 gigabytes. Okay. So, running out of time, but I'll just talk a little bit more about where this k equals n to the power r comes from. I want to show you, under some reasonable assumptions, that k should be equal to n to the power r. So one of the assumptions is that k is a function of n. So k for a particular type of system is some function of the maximum number of distinguishable states. Another assumption is that k, this function, has the property that k of n plus 1 is greater than k of n. So if you increase the amount of information you can carry by the system, then you increase the number of probabilities required to specify that state of that type of system. And both of these properties will follow from the postulates that I'll write down, I guess, on Monday. Okay, so then if you also assume that there exist systems which have n equal to 1, n equal to 2, 3, etc., then you can show that k is equal to n to the power r. Okay, and this just requires a bit of number theory. An intermediate step is it follows from, sorry, so you assume this, and there's two properties here. So let's see, so 1, 2, three, 4, 5, and then this follows. And it's just some number theory. I think very basic number theory if you're a number theorist. For me, much more difficult. And an intermediate step is that you have this property. So this function k has to have this property. This is called a completely multiplicative function. So you look in the number theory literature, this function is called that. And then you look at these kinds of functions and you do a prime decomposition of n, and you can prove that this is true. And not difficult to prove. And so
So one way to get some insight into what's happening, I think it's interesting just to look at quantum theory with complex, real, and quaternionic cases. Well, you can first of all, you can think about expanding this function k of n like this. Okay. And the motivation for this is, imagine you have an n-dimensional system. Let's represent that by, you know, each of the distinguishable outcomes is represented by a point. And then associated with each individual of these distinguishable outcomes, you have x1 degrees of freedom. And then associated with each pair here, for example, you have another x2, and so on. With each triple, x3. And so k is counting up all the contributions. In the case of now of quantum theory, well, in the case of classical theory, the vector x, which is each of these components, is equal to 1, 0, that, okay, because we just have k equals n. In the quantum case with complex numbers, we have x equals 1, 2, 0, 0. If we have the quantum case with real numbers, we have that, and if it's quaternions, one, four, like so. Okay. So this thing is a kind of a signature, if you like, and it and you can see these different theories have different signatures. If you had k equals n cubed, then you have to get into, you have to populate the x3. So now you have degrees of freedom which are associated not just with pairs, but with triples. Okay. This relates very strongly to something that, interesting work by Raphael Sorkin, where he talks about higher order interference. So I won't have time to talk about that, but it's very interesting work. Maybe just finally, I'll quickly draw this table. So this is the real complex and quaternionic cases of quantum theory. And consider where the Hilbert space dimension is 2 and where it's 4. Okay. If the Hilbert space dimension is 2, in standard quantum theory, you need n squared probabilities, so k is equal to 4. And if the Hilbert space dimension is 4, you need 16. Okay. And this fits with if you have a composite system. So if you have two qubits, each of them has dimension 2, the total system has dimension 4, and Ka equals, so Kab equals Ka times Kb. So 16 is 4 times 4. Everything fits together nicely here. If you have the real case, well, we did the calculation over here. Instead of having a 2 at the top there, you have a 1. And then for n equals 2, you have 3. And for n equal to 4, you have 10. And 10 is bigger than 9, bigger than 3 squared. So if you have two of these real qubits, each has k equal to 3. So Ka times Kb is equal to 9. But when you put the two together, you actually have 10 degrees of freedom. So you have an extra degree of freedom associated with the composite that can't be accounted for, which is strange. And the quaternionic case is even weirder. So if you use that formula over there, then for each of the systems of dimension 2, with n equal to 2, you get k equals 6. But for a system which has n equal to 4, you get k equals 28, which is, I did the calculation earlier, less than 6 squared. So now you have fewer degrees of freedom in the composite than you would expect to have coming from the two components. And I think the conclusion here is that the quaternionic case actually doesn't make sense. It isn't possible. It violates some very basic assumptions. Whereas the real case is possible in some. Okay. And that's the end of that. On Monday, I'll write down the postulates. Monday, I'll write down the postulates. Get in with it. Any questions?
Explain what 166 picture.
Yeah, if you, if you write down any polynomial function of k, you can solve and find what those x's are. Okay, so I wrote, if you write down n cubed, then you get one. You get x one equal to one, x two equal to six, x three equal to six, and then the rest are equal.
So is it corresponding to some kind of theory? Or?
Well, that's the question. Can you now construct a theory where you construct the state spaces, a full theory that makes sense, which has k equals into the power of 3? And people have tried to do that and not really found anything that's very physical, but it makes much sense. But one big hope is that if you compare quantum and classical, okay, then you can sort of tell the history of physics like this. For a long time, we didn't have experiments that were sensitive enough to probe 2, so we just saw this, okay, and then eventually we found experiments that we could probe interference. So this is interference, and so that's where we discovered the 2. Maybe there's and going from here to here is a kind of decoherence. So maybe it's possible that that actually really nature is described by a higher order theory. It's just we haven't been able to probe these higher order effects yet. So that's a nice story, but nothing I've seen makes the story compelling. Like there isn't a nice hierarchy of theories that work. And in fact, with very natural assumptions, you can really rule out k equals n cubed.
Does tomographic locality means that, like, if I perform some local measurements of some part of my system,
mm-hmm.
then another local measurement of the other part of the system would be independent of the result of this one?
Okay, that's not what tomographic locality means. No, that's a conceptually different sort of thing. So tomographic locality is tomography is in this context making measurements to establish the state. And the question is, can you make measurements to establish the state by just doing local measurements? Okay. And in quantum theory, you can. You perform a measurement over here and a measurement over here. And then you look at the joint probability over those measurements, and then you can establish what the state is. That's what homographic locality is.
Even for like, I'm trying to think about the non-local features that we see in entanglement. For
yeah. Yes. Yeah, so what's interesting is so you might say, well, you know, quantum theory is non-local, so we're used to all sorts of crazy stuff. But actually, in this respect, quantum theory is kind of conservative. It is local. It has the same property as the classical theory. You can establish global state by local measurements. So even though quantum theory has entanglement, it still has this property, homographic locality. It's not as non-local. It's not as crazy as it could be. Real Hilbert space theory. That's crazy. Quantum theory that.
And then assuming all of this four, we definitely get a K which doesn't have any coefficient beside n to the power r. So I mean, like, just assuming this four, we're saying that like the probabilities cannot be quadrant, cannot be real or...
Yeah, so if we make those assumptions, if we assume
if you want local
homographic locality in particular, then it rules out is it rules out the complex, the real and the quaternionic cases. People have studied quaternionic quantum theory. There's a book by Stephen Adler on quaternionic quantum theory. And I don't know what his reaction is to this kind of argument. And I think it's maybe he's just thinking in a different way. In this kind of operational framework, these quaternionic cases, they violate some very basic ideas. They violate the idea. You have two circuits that are separate. They're two disjoint circuits. One over here, one over here. Then you'd expect the probabilities for those two circuits to factorize. They would have to violate that. So they're quite strange theories.
Is it the same book that he has on trace dynamics?
No, he has another book on trace dynamics. He has a much older book on quaternionic quantum theory. He was thinking more in the continuous Hilbert space, continuous dimensional Hilbert space picture. So perhaps those arguments, perhaps that's
those arguments.
I think I actually asked him once about this. It's sometimes hard to different languages
to understand.
So I don't understand.
Can you play the same game with octonionic quantities?
I don't know if anyone's ever done that, and I don't know why. But then that you have, then those things are octonions, crazier than quaternions even. But definitely, if you put an 8, whatever it is, I know what 8 is. If you put an even higher number, it's going to get even worse. So from this point of view, it wouldn't get better. But I think even before you do that, I think there are other problems.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to ask, where is the crucial step from, real numbers to complex numbers and then complex to quaternions? Like, is it just saying that the off-diagonals of the density matrix can take on Hermitian?
Yeah, those. Yeah, so that's the step in this framework. The idea is that your density matrices can take real or quaternionic entries.
And does it mean anything? Like, to me, this table looks like there's some sort of redundancy in the description. Like, if we were using complex numbers over real numbers, it seems like there's some sort of redundancy because we need more numbers to specify.
Yeah, so you can compare the real and the complex case. It's interesting to do so. One way to think about it is to look at the sigma matrices. So you have sigma x, sigma y, and sigma z. So sigma x and sigma z have just real entries. Sigma y has a complex in it. If you also include the identity, then the identity sigma x, sigma y, sigma z, that's a set of four Hermitian operators that span the space of Hermitian operators. So that connects to this four here. But you have to cross out the y one when you go to the real case, because it's got an imaginary number in it. So then you just have three. But if you take sigma y times sigma y, so if you take a tensor product of two sigma y, so sigma a y times sigma b y, then you get a real Hermitian operator again. So that's the extra one that crops up. Yes, Kanya, what about this?
Jordan formulated something where the matrices commute but are not associative. He called it as Jordan algebra.
Yeah.
Because these density matrices are Hermitian as well, with complex or quaternionic entries. So is this somehow a form, is density matrix approach somehow related to Jordan's formalism?
Yeah, I don't. It's a good question. I haven't done the background work to be able to answer that question. People have thought about this kind of thing in the quantum foundations. I'm the wrong person to ask. I can certainly give you references.
I was wondering how the research was actually started.
How this research was started? Which one? Sorry, which?
I thought this is your.
So the concept, the axioms. So I spent all this time talking about these interpretations, and that was kind of where the field was in the 1990s. I, to be honest, at a certain point, I found it kind of depressing because I didn't see how you can make any progress in physics along those lines. Even though these were really important fundamental questions, I couldn't see how you would make progress. And then Chris Fuchs, who I mentioned earlier, he promotes the cubist approach. But this was a while back when he was just starting to get those ideas. He was trying to push people to come up with an information theoretic derivation of the axioms of quantum theory. So I was very strongly influenced by that. He gave lots of lectures. So he invited me to a conference in Montreal, also organized by Brazard, who'd also been asking this kind of question. So I started working on it then. In the end, I had to cancel going to the conference. So that's where it came from me, was this approach. And in the meantime, since then, in the last 20 years, there's been a lot of people working on axiomatic approaches, deriving quantum theory from reasonable postulates. And some of those sets of postulates are in some ways better than the ones I'm going to show you on Monday. Although I think the ones I'm going to show you on Monday are very good pedagogically. Right, Dan, there's been a lot more work done. Yeah.
Just another last thing here, when we think about, we just require this projection operator to have this complex structure.
Yeah.
But we're not talking about, how we construct this state of the system. If we can have any way to, construct it in a real way or quadratic way, and then the projection operator be complex out of it, the total projection operator at the end. It doesn't limit how we're going to construct the theory. It just limits how we're going to construct the projection operators themselves.
What does you have complex or reals? So yeah, but that's a big restriction, because then it determines the size of the space, and then also the composite structure as well. So it's limited by that. So it is a big restriction. No one seriously thinks that nature is really described by real, this real case. But there's the fermionic case. There's papers where the fermionic case actually does look like it violates holographic locality. So these considerations do start to become relevant to real physics. That's something that Sukanya and I are looking at. There's a paper on this by Carinotti as well.